You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Okay, can I be totally honest? I am not quite sure what I was thinking when I decided to preach on this passage. I mean, who preaches on this passage? Well, hardly anybody, I discovered. I asked retired clergy and other colleagues how they had approached this passage, and to a person, they all replied, "What? You're preaching on that? Good luck, Sparky." Well, as it turns out, today's passage is at the top of most people's "he said what" lists, and for good reason. It doesn't sound like anything Jesus would say. And as it turns out, he probably didn't say it, but there it is, not only in Matthew, but it's in Thomas, and courtesy of our mystery gospel Q, it's in Luke too. But again, despite all these occurrences, when do you hear it preached on? Never, pretty much. But seeing that I'm here and you're here and I can't stall anymore, I might as well take you with me down the rabbit hole. First off, remember that Matthew was written some 50 years after Jesus' death, but using material from that much earlier gospel scholars call Q that we don't actually have a copy of. Our passage today also appears in the Gospel of Thomas, so you know our passage is likely a very, very early and oft-told saying of Jesus. But what Jesus is reported to have said was actually lifted in large part from the prophetic words of Micah. Why? Probably because the early church was trying to gain credibility by having Jesus allude to Micah and acknowledge that in Micah's time and in Jesus' time, or now, whenever you challenge the status quo, the response is going to be the same: strife and division. And the dangerous territory challenge today is the influence of family power. And the author is so attuned to the potential destructiveness of the family that he attributes to Jesus perhaps one of the most shocking things he ever said. Using the metaphor of a sword, Jesus warns people, "Look, I am not here to make nice. I'm here to bust things up." In the context of the whole chapter, Jesus is sending the disciples out to spread the gospel and issuing warning after warning. He says, "Look, you're going to be rejected, so get ready. And don't think it's going to be any easier with your families. It may just be worse." Matthew even wraps up the passage putting words of warning in Jesus' mouth that only make sense from a post-Easter perspective. In other words, Jesus probably never actually said it himself. It was added by the church later. He said, "You have to take up your cross and follow me." As you take in this passage today, remember the context from which it came. Roman occupation was stressing Jewish society to the breaking point, turning Jew against Jew, and undermining long-held customs and traditions. Now families were being torn apart by people going over from Judaism to this crazy Galilean cult. The fact that these sentiments appear so early and so often in our gospel records suggests that people were literally having to make a choice between family and following Jesus. And in some left-handed effort to comfort those who were suffering, it appears that the gospel writers put Micah's words in Jesus' mouth after the fact, suggesting that this was Jesus' plan all along. See what you think.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 10, verses 34 through 39.
Jesus said, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace on the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword.
For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And one's foes will be members in one's own household.
Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me.
Those who find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
It's the damn gays! They're destroying our families! It's the drag queens and the trans whatever they are. They're grooming our children! It's sex ed in the schools, causing teenagers to have babies! It's mothers working outside the home. It's absentee fathers! It's welfare! It's not enough prayer in our schools! All these forces are breaking down our families! Really? Or is this all projection and distraction from the fact that families themselves are often the biggest problems and stress producers? And instead of dealing with that reality, fearful people are desperate to blame anybody but themselves. But you know the one person they're not blaming for the breakdown of the family? Jesus. That's right. Even though in our passage today, Jesus seems to make his mission pretty clear. "For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and one's foes will be members of one's own household." What? Why would Jesus say such a thing? Well, he probably didn't. New Testament scholars agree that this passage, far from being Jesus' own words, are a creation of the very early Jesus movement that reflect the reality of what was happening in the development of the early church. Families were being torn apart, were being divided over commitment to Jesus. Remember, Matthew is probably the most Jewish of our Gospels. And this passage probably reflects the reality of the pain and division being experienced by those who felt they had to choose between their Jewish upbringing and following Jesus. So, the reality of what people were experiencing are put on Jesus' lips by the gospel writer as though it was Jesus' plan to divide families. Now, maybe that's true, maybe not. But you've got to admit, they'd be encouraging words to those who'd been rejected by their families for following that crazy Galilean heretic. But wait, there are other examples where Jesus clearly expresses, at best, ambivalence about families, including his own. Remember when someone asked to go tend to their father's burial before following Jesus? Jesus said, "Oh, please, enough with the excuses. Let the dead bury their own dead." Or when Jesus' mother and brothers tried to get his attention in the middle of a mob of followers, Jesus outright dissed them and asked, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" Then he pointed to his gathered followers and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." Clearly, Jesus was up to something. Outcasts were his family. His disciples were little children. At the very least, it appears that he was redefining the family beyond the traditional understandings of blood and tradition.
But wait, you say, the family is a sacred institution enshrined in the pages of the Bible.
Oh, really? Show me. Oh, you probably mean Abraham, who fathered children by two women, one of whom was a slave, who probably should have called Child Protective Services on the old geezer. No? How about Jacob? He was tricked into marrying his first wife, Leah, and then only stayed married to her so he could get to Rachel. Oh, and there were also his two concubines to boot. Maybe you mean King David, who murdered the husband of his mistress and eventually had eight wives altogether. Or his son Solomon, who had 700 wives and 300 concubines. How many mothers-in-law did that entail? Then there's the couple who make passionate love to one another in the Song of Songs, who are apparently doing so without the benefit of marriage. And then there's that beautiful expression of love between David and his lover, Jonathan, whose love for one another, quote, surpassed the love of women, unquote. How about the New Testament? Depending on whether you're Catholic or not, Joseph and Mary never consummated their marriage because Mary needed to stay a perpetual virgin. We know Simon Peter was married because Jesus healed his mother-in-law, but we don't know much else. We hear of various other married couples here and there. Priscilla and Aquila were commended as teachers and leaders, but Ananias and Sapphira were struck down by God for hoarding money. The long and short of it, it's almost impossible to find what we've come to think of as a traditional nuclear family anywhere in the Bible. Yet, the way some people talk, you'd assume you could turn to almost any page of the Bible and find idyllic American families with mom, dad, and 2.5 children. In fact, there's a virtual cottage industry among conservative Christians in promoting Christian family values, most of which entail promoting a toxic purity culture, suppression of women, and the exclusion of LGBTQIA folks altogether. So, before we go on, let's agree. Whatever your idea is of the ideal family, living into that idea carries certain cultural power with the influence to affect the way people live, for good or for ill. Families in Jesus' day were arranged in patriarchal clans. Family members owed their highest allegiance to the head of their clan, be he father, brother, uncle, nephew, or cousin. As insurance for old age, illness, conflict, loyalty to the clan was expected above all else. But there was a dark side. It was inwardly focused. And as John Dominic Crossan says, through suspicion, fear, and parochialism, it often functioned to keep peasants, peasants. To get an idea of how that family allegiance works in our culture today, you need not look any further than the 14 words. What are the 14 words? They make up the most popular white supremacist slogan in the world. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Often seen in graffiti, along with white supremacist code for Heil Hitler, 88. H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. You see 1488 all over the place. Once you know it, you see it everywhere. It was even scrawled on our own church wall by vandals a few years ago. 1488 reflects the primary worldview of a huge chunk of people who see themselves as a family bound together by their whiteness, and that unless immediate action is taken, the white race is doomed to extinction by a rising tide of color, controlled and manipulated by Jews. Add to that the various pedophile conspiracies and drag queen controversies promoted by QAnon, and you got yourself all the suspicion and fear you need to manipulate people into hateful and violent actions against others. These are the kind of family values that Jesus is calling us to be done with. Remember, in Jesus' day, family meant this extended economic and political network of relationships to which unquestioned loyalty was expected. Jesus was seeking to expand the definition of what a family could be. It's not mom and dad raising kids, but your neighbor, unrelated by blood or marriage, the foreigner in your midst, even your enemy. And guess what? This idea was and still is threatening to many people. But to those who are victims of the dark side of whatever the culture has decided family is, it was an invitation to acceptance, affirmation, and new life. In fact, Jesus wraps up today's passage with this cryptic kind of koan: those who find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. What are we finding and losing? First off, if we get caught up trying to please everyone else and fulfilling long-held family expectations, we can genuinely lose our authentic selves, right? What do you stand for? Be yourself. The power of family expectations can stifle and oppress people to the point that, in order to experience new life, those expectations need to be rejected. The unquestioned power that family represents can perpetuate systems of injustice, prejudice, and oppression on both individuals and on all of society. Taken literally, we wriggle uncomfortably when Jesus asserts that to love father, mother, son, or daughter more than we love Jesus is to make ourselves unworthy. But when we understand the capacity for family expectations to straitjacket us in the status quo and become inwardly focused, ignoring the world, of course it makes sense for Jesus to say, all right, break it up, break it up. A big part of becoming a follower of Jesus is to break out of the mindset of scarcity and move into a mindset of abundance. Unconditional, radical love cannot, by definition, operate on the theory that there is only so much love to go around. And being a follower of Jesus is not about rationing a diminishing supply of love for just one's immediate family. It's about embracing the reality that expanding the definition of one's family expands the availability of love available for all people. Let me assure you, those who are alienated from blood relations, those struggling with broken relationships, those who are far away from family and lonely, those who've been intentionally cut off from their family of origin, get this. And let's be honest, not everyone in your family may be thrilled about you following Jesus and putting love first in the particular way the Fountains does. If Jesus was trying to move his first century listeners away from placing the authority of the clan above all else, he is calling us, his 21st century audience to loosen our grip as well and see the interconnectedness of us all. I don't know, maybe you're from the George Burns school of thought. Happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family in another city. But in the end, I think Jesus would lean more towards the sentiment of author Jim Butcher. When everything goes to hell, the people who stand by you without flinching, they are your family. Fiorello LaGuardia was mayor of New York City during the worst days of the Great Depression and all of World War II. He was called by adoring New Yorkers the Little Flower because he was only 5'4" and always wore a carnation in his lapel. He was a colorful character who used to ride the New York City fire trucks, raid speakeasies with the police department, take entire orphanages to baseball games, and whenever the New York newspapers were on strike, he used to go on the radio and read the Sunday funnies to the kids. One bitterly cold night in January of 1935, the mayor turned up at a night court that served the poorest ward of the city. LaGuardia dismissed the judge for the evening and took over the bench himself. Within a few minutes, a tattered old woman was brought before him, charged with stealing a loaf of bread. She told LaGuardia that her daughter's husband had deserted her. Her daughter was sick, and her grandchildren were starving. But the shopkeeper from whom the bread was stolen refused to drop the charges. "It's a bad neighborhood, Your Honor," the man told the mayor. "She's got to be punished to teach other people around here a lesson." LaGuardia sighed. He turned to the woman and said, "I've got to punish you. The law makes no exceptions. $10 or 10 days in jail." But even as he pronounced sentence, the mayor was already reaching into his pocket. He extracted a bill and tossed it into his famous sombrero, saying, "Here's the $10 fine, which I now remit. And furthermore, I'm going to fine everyone in this courtroom 50 cents for living in a town where a person has to steal bread so that her grandchildren can eat. Mr. Bailiff, collect the fines and give them to the defendant." So the following day, the New York City newspapers reported that $47.50 was turned over to a bewildered old lady who had stolen a loaf of bread to feed her starving grandchildren. 50 cents of that amount having been contributed by the red-faced grocery store owner himself, while some 70 petty criminals, people with traffic violations, and New York City policemen, each of whom had just paid 50 cents for the privilege of doing so, gave the mayor a standing ovation. Remember, as much as you'd like to believe it, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, lover of us all, is not the patron saint of the close-knit nuclear family. His radical demands encourage us to prioritize the transformative power of the kingdom of God. And guess what? That allegiance may disrupt our earthly relationships. But that's to be expected. The transformation Jesus offers means losing our old lives in favor of a new way of living, even if it seems like someone has taken a sword to the delicate fabric of our carefully maintained ideas. Jesus' words were shocking 2,000 years ago, and they're shocking today. But when someone demands that our old, counterproductive understanding of family should be abandoned in favor of a vision of the whole of humanity being our family, of course it's shocking. It's hard to not dismiss it as just pie-in-the-sky idealism. But if you're going to lose your life for something, don't you think it's worth aiming for the high bar? Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.